A, B, C Radio, Brisbane and Queensland.
Streaming now at abc.net.au/Brisbane.
And you're with Kelly Higgins Devine. What do these animals have in common? The dogs sniffing around our bags at the airport, the sugar glider controlling insect numbers, or the cyborg bees helping scientists with environmental change. They're all animal eco-warriors. And there's a really cool book the CSIRO has just published that's perfect for the animal lover at your house. It's by Nick Gill, and it's called Animal Eco-Warriors, Humans and Animals Working Together to Protect Our Planet. Author and receiver of many animal bites researching this book, Nick Gill, hello.
Hey, Kelly, how you going?
Good, good. Bees. Let's start with bees because they're an endless source of fascination. You looked at bees both here and overseas. What did you find?
I was chatting to Professor Paolo D'Souza, who works down here in Tassie for CSIRO, but he's actually part of a network of scientists all over the world looking at what he jokingly calls the Internet of Stings. So all over the world, there are scientists like who are working, sticking tiny little microchips on bees and studying their movements to work out how environmental change is impacting their numbers.
Well, we've got a bee expert up here who was telling us one day about bees doing a little dance with their bums, to the little bum dance that tells other bees where to go to flowers.
Oh, yeah. Amazing. Bees are very sophisticated.
Yeah.
For things with what appear to be tiny little brains, they are capable of very complex behaviours, which we still really don't understand how they manage.
So these Tassie bees that are microchipped, what sort of data are they giving?
Well, the ones they're looking at here in Tasmania, there are a bunch of hives stuck up behind the University of Tasmania that Paolo and his team keep an eye on. And they're looking at the impact of changes in, say, weather events. They're looking at impacts of pesticides on the lives of bees. And, yeah, because the bees have got these little chips, they know exactly when they leave their hives and when they return. So when a worker bee goes on her mission, they call it, she goes past the little sensor at the start of the hive and kind of beeps past it a little bit like your groceries at the checkout. And so they can track how long she's going out for. So if it's a really nice day, she might go on a whole bunch of missions, and some of them might be quite long. So anything longer than 6 or 7 minutes is a long mission.
Yep.
But if the weather's bad, she might just get up and walk to the door and kind of look around and just sort of go, and then just go back inside and not go out at all.
If only we could do the same thing. Look out the door on a rainy morning and go, you know what? I don't think so. I'm going back to bed.
Well, in certain professions, we can do that. So some jobs are weather dependent, but yes, for the most part, yeah, we don't quite have the relative freedom of the bees in that respect.
Yeah. So are the workers all female?
Yes, all of the workers are female.
Mm-hmm. And the drones would be male?
Yes, the drones are male.
And of course, the queen is the queen, so.
That is right. So the drones, their job is pretty much just getting the queen up the duff on her maiden flight. And she collects all that she needs from her maiden flight to produce all of the eggs that she will lay in her lifetime.
And now every man listening wants to be a drone.
To be honest, I'm not sure being a drone is the best life. I think I'd probably be rather one of the worker bees. Well, you know, I don't think your life is quite as long and quite as exciting as it is if, say, you're a worker bee. You don't
But you've only got one thing you've got to do.
That's true.
Now, how do bees move? Do they stay within their own hives?
Well, one of the things that the team down here have discovered is that bees actually have sleepovers, which I had no idea about. But because they can see where individual bees are going, they had four hives down here, and most bees would stay in their own hive. They would go out, do their missions, come back at night, sleep in their own hive. But some of them would go for slumber parties at nearby hives. So they're all in the sort of same area. It sort of suggests that they are one colony in four different buildings, a little bit like, say, a college dorm or something like that. But, yeah, there were two hives, Hive 2 and Hive 4, they discovered, like, really didn't like one another. So bees from, you know, Hive 1 would go to 2, 3 or 4 quite happily. Mm-hmm. But bees from Hive 2 would go to 1 or 3, but they wouldn't visit 4. The scientists, yes, mentioned them being a little bit like the Montagues and the Capulets in Romeo and Juliet. It was like they had some kind of feud. So
nothing
they weren't sure why
on.
That was. Well, they actually played a bit of a trick on the bees, which was a little bit mean, but bees are a little bit like us. They're kind of lazy in that they will use visual cues to make decisions about where they are. So say if you live in an apartment block and you know that you live in like apartment 12 on the floor, Like, they all look pretty much the same. The doors, you'll wander along home and you'll see the number 12 and you're like, oh, it's mine. But if someone changed the numbers on your door, you probably would accidentally walk into the wrong hive or house, which is exactly what the bees did. They had some symbols above the hives. I think they had like a green triangle and a blue square on 2 and 4, and they switched them. And so the bees who had gone out on their missions came back and went to the wrong hives, and they quickly realised they were in the wrong hives, and there was a bit of a bee brawl, so they quickly changed them back.
Well, no wonder they're not getting along.
I know. Well, yes, that was a bit mischievous of the scientists, but they were trying to work out whether or not the bees were using those visual cues to find their hives.
And they were. So,
yeah,
but then they got in there and went, wait a minute, I don't know you.
This isn't right. You're not my people. So, yeah.
We also found out, Nick, about stingless bees in South America and how they then protect the hive, given they've got no sting.
Oh, I love the stingless bees. They're called Melipona. They're a stingless bee that produces honey, but because they're stingless bees, they can't protect themselves in the way that some of the more aggressive bees with stings do. So Paolo de Souza, the researcher in Tassie, goes to the Amazon rainforest once a year because he's Brazilian.
Because he can.
Because he can. And so he studies not only domestic honeybees, but also wild bees, who are, of course, very important for the pollination of wild forest ecosystems.
Mm.
And the Melipona are these tiny little bees who have had to come up with some clever ways to guard their hives. Now, one of the things they've done is they've designed the entrance to their hives a little bit differently to other bees. So there's a little bit of a kink when you come in the door of the hive, so you can't fly straight in. And in that kink sits a guard bee. And if she sees something threatening coming along, say like a big bumblebee that might be coming to steal some honey, she emits a hormone, and the other bees in the hive smell the hormone, and I particularly love this bit, they roll a little clay ball that they've built themselves in front of a hole, and they hold it in front of the hole, like flapping the little wings, and that means nothing can get past. So they've effectively rolled the door shut.
Fantastic.
And they'll keep doing that until she stops releasing that fear hormone or the warning hormone. So, I think that's a pretty good start. But they're not just working at the micro level. They're also thinking about larger animals that may potentially want to steal their honey. And they're very good crafters of mud, and they'll make their hives out of all sorts of things, including mud and sometimes animal poo, which doesn't make it particularly tasty. But they will build, they'll sculpt a tarantula at the entrance to their hive. And scientists working there will often be scared because they'll think there is a real spider there. But the Melipona have just been busy building deterrents to people who might be wanting to study them
<That's>
or steal
brilliant.
Their honey. It's amazing.
It is.
You just wonder how such a behaviour evolved. It's quite complicated, like sculpting something like that and, thinking about other animals looking at it.
Yeah, well, let's go to the micro wasps on Christmas Island. What are they up to?
Well, the micro wasps on Christmas Island are actually involved in a really interesting form of biological control. Now, I know a lot of people, when they think of biological control, think, oh, cane toads, it's dangerous, what a disaster. And that was a disaster. But biological control has come a long way since the days of the release of the cane toad for cane beetles that they couldn't reach because they were up in the sugar cane and the cane toads were on the ground.
Yeah. But design fault.
It's amazing no one picked that up. Anyway, on Christmas Island, they're having a real problem with an outbreak of a really nasty, aggressive ant called the yellow crazy ant. Mm. So they're a really aggressive, competitive group of ants, and they adapt to new environments like quite rapidly. And unlike a lot of other ants, they will form super colonies. So they'll have multiple queens, and rather than fighting over resources, they'll work together to obtain resources. And as many people probably know, Christmas Island is the land of the crabs. So there are crabs everywhere, and they're a really important part of maintaining the forests there. So they maintain a clear understory and allow the forests to maintain their good health. But in areas where the crazy ants are, they're killing the crabs. So what the scientists are trying over there is, rather than controlling the crazy ants themselves directly, they're trying to control one of their most important food sources. So there are these scale insects that the ants farm. So you know when you get like little lerps and things on your houseplants?
Mm-hmm.
They might like exude a kind of sticky, gummy thing. So they these scale insects on Christmas Island are a really important food source for the crazy ants, and they exude a kind of honeydew, and it causes the crazy ants to behave even more crazily than usual. They're like toddlers on red cordial.
Mm-hmm.
And they're hoping that this wasp, which is a parasite of the scale insect, will cause the scale insect numbers to drop so far that there won't be enough food to support the crazy ant population. And so the numbers will naturally subside with the loss of their prime food resource. So
okay.
It's called secondary biological control because they're not targeting the main pest organism. They're targeting its food source, which is also an introduced species there.
All right. So introducing a species to control the species that was introduced to control the species that was introduced.
It's a little bit like the old lady who swallowed the fly. Yep.
But yeah, it's amazing.
This yellow lax scale insect that the ants rely upon, it's kind of amazing that it got to the island without its natural parasites. So the scientists who were researching it, normally when these things sneak across onto islands, some of them will be parasitized, so they'll bring their own natural biological control in their native environment. Like, you'll only ever see like a couple of them here and there because most of them are controlled by these wasps. So they're very specific. This will hopefully balance things out a little bit and make it a bit less easy for the crazy ants to dominate the island.
Nick Gill with me on ABC Radio Brisbane and Queensland. You're with Kelly Higgins-Devine. And Nick Gill's book is called Animal Eco-Warriors, Humans and Animals Working Together to Protect Our Planet. Now, we know dogs have an amazing sense of smell. Just how good is it and how did you see it in action?
Oh, I was lucky enough to go out with a whole bunch of detection dogs as part of this project, and they worked in all sorts of areas. So later I think you'll speak to Roman, who works
with the koala poo sniffing dog. Yes.
That was a fantastic adventure, but I'll let Roman talk to you about that. I also went out with dogs that specialise in finding cat poo on islands that are important for seabird habitat. And I went out with the biosecurity detection beagles of Hobart Airport, who are quite hilarious. Now, I'm sure if any of you have been to Tasmania, you will have met one of our beagles. They are very dedicated to their job.
Yes.
But yes, they have. And part of the reason they're so good at it is because they've got a nose that is better than almost anybody else's. So in our noses as people, like, if you spread out the bits of your nose that has scent detection cells in it, it's about the same size as a postage stamp. If you spread that bit out in dogs, it's about the same size as a piece of A4 paper. So to start with, they've already got like a much larger area devoted to scent. They've also got like a special organ that we don't have called Jacobson's organ, which is kind of at the back of their throat. It smells pheromones, so that gives them a lot of information about other dogs and animals in the area. It smells the sex hormones, so they get that extra information. And beagles particularly, you know how they've got those adorable, like, floppy ears and, you know, the flobbly-looking lips? The flopping around that happens when they're running around actually pushes more air into their noses, so they get an extra good whiff of things that are around. So they're so much better at smelling than we are. Do you reckon you'd notice if someone put a teaspoon of sugar in a hot chocolate for you?
Oh, probably not.
Yeah, I don't know. You might or you might not.
Yeah.
But, you know, beagles would smell a teaspoon of sugar, the equivalent of, or taste a teaspoon of sugar if you stirred it into a mug of hot chocolate the size of two Olympic swimming pools. That's how sensitive they are.
Wow. It's crazy, isn't it? We talked to a dog trainer not so long ago who was saying that if you had a pancake stack the size of Mount Kosciuszko, that you would actually get dogs would be able to pick out the one with lemon on it. That's how
totally
good
would.
Their sense of smell is. Like, and that, like, you know, it's better, but not that much better. That's crazy.
It's phenomenal.
Good. Yeah.
It is absolutely phenomenal. And I think what's particularly phenomenal about the beagles down at the airport is they were all taken off death row. They're all dogs that have been brought back to the pound multiple times, and it was their last chance. And so there's an organisation for beagles called Beagle Rescue, and they're notorious for being bought as pets because they're adorable looking, but they're just really, they're a special needs kind of dog. they need a lot of work.
They get bored really fast. And
they do get bored.
I've got a friend who's got one, and their beagle just destroyed their backyard and everything they put in it, and that's just what they do.
Yeah, no, they get bored and they can smell amazing things like from blocks away, and so that makes them great escape artists.
Yeah.
Rhonda, the chief dog handler at the airport, talks about them being absolute Houdinis. They're fabulous at, like, getting out of places that they shouldn't. And yeah, they have a huge food drive, so they're really excited to work for food. So these dogs that were just world's worst pets are actually the best dogs to have at the airport because they'll do anything for food. So if you tell them you need them to find apples or lemons or anything else that might be bringing in pests that could be bad for the Tasmanian environment or for agriculture, they will find those things for you. And, you know, then they will demand food. They really couldn't be bothered with pats. They're not interested. A lot of the other
dogs
in the
book.
No, a lot of the other dogs in the book work for love or like for a tennis ball to throw. But beagles are just like, nah,
where's the food? I might have been a beagle in a former life. Now, the conservation dogs as well, they're pretty clever. They're finding fungus that kills kauri pines. So training these dogs to be able to search out things that we can't, that are either hard to see or hard for us to find, but become very easy for them to find. Like it's a great little relationship that's formed there.
Oh, it's extraordinary, and it's a field that's quite rapidly evolving in Australia. I think New Zealand in some areas are a little bit ahead of the curve. I went over and met with a whole bunch of detection dog handlers there, but it's really, it's only like our imaginations that limit what dogs can use their noses to find. It's quite extraordinary. There was one particular dog team that I profiled working at Mount Kosciuszko National Park with the Department of Conservation there. And they're looking for a particularly nasty daisy called orange hawkweed. They're looking for hawkweeds. They're an allelopathic plant, which means that they kill things around them. So they kill the other things that grow near them. But the dogs that work on those, they're these gorgeous little spaniels. They can smell this plant. They're so good, they can smell them before they even get a leaf above the soil. And this is in amongst a whole bunch of different types of daisies. So they weren't sure whether or not they'd be able to do it, but not. They're clever enough and, their noses are fine enough to do it. And they really like tennis balls, so they will work for tennis balls.
Now, tell us about elephant seals, Nick, and what they can tell us about ocean currents and temperatures.
Well, the elephant seals are quite extraordinary beasts. Unfortunately, I didn't get to meet them in person, although I'm told by marine biologists that work with them routinely that was actually probably a blessing for my nasal cavity. Now, my nose is not as good as a beagle's, but apparently it would be quite insulted by a close proximity to an elephant seal. So scientists down south in the Antarctic and subantarctic are using these devices called CTD devices. They measure conductivity, temperature and depth of ocean water. And they basically sneak up to elephant seals and give them a needle to anaesthetise them. And they stick them on their heads. And when the elephant seals wake up and go back to their everyday business, every time they go for a dive to, you know, find something to eat, and they might dive up to 2 kilometres down, they're constantly taking measurements of conductivity, temperature and depth. And what this gives the scientists is an insight into the currents flowing around under the ice. And there's no other way for them to get this information. In other areas of open water, they can use these things called Argo floats, which are basically little automatic devices that can float up and down in the water column. And then when they get back to the surface, they can transmit information. But if there's ice in the way, you can't do that. But the elephant seals go under the ice all the time. So they actually collect the bulk of this climate science data below about 60 degrees latitude. So, you know, down in the Antarctic sort of circle area.
Now, rats, the mere mention of them may send shivers down the spine, but they're being used in rather inventive ways.
Oh, I love the rats of Apopo. Apopo is an organisation based in Tanzania in Africa, and they have a training centre there where they specialise in training rats for a number of humanitarian activities, one of which is clearing landmines from war zones. So there's a chapter in the book that focuses on these. They're not your regular everyday house rats, although you could do this with a regular everyday house rat. They're a giant pouched rat, so they're a bit bigger. And
rodents of unusual size.
They are rodents.
For the Princess Bride fans.
They are rodents of unusual size and intelligence. They're very bright. And they're very friendly, and they are being trained to sniff out TNT, which is the active constituent in a lot of unexploded ordnances. So they might be like shells that have been dropped by planes or landmines. And there are lots of areas throughout the world, particularly in Africa and Southeast Asia, where local people can't farm their land or walk safely to school. because these unexploded ordnances are still there from wars that are long over. So the rats are trained to go into areas and to sniff out where the landmines are. And because they're so light, they can't set them off. So there's no risk to the rats themselves. None of them have ever been killed by a landmine. So they train them initially at a special facility where they've got a whole bunch of sand pits set up, and they have these things that look more or less like tea infusers that they will fill with TNT and bury about the place. And so they'll train the rats to begin with in an area that has TNT but no live mines. But by the time they're about 10 months old, they're ready to go into the field with their handler and make landscape safe for people to live and farm in again. They're quite amazing.
Fantastic. And finally, the farmer in Bega, New South Wales, using sugar gliders to control insects.
Oh, yes. No, in Tasmania, sugar gliders are a bit of a pest, and so we aren't particularly fond of them. But on the mainland, as we call it, in Bega, Doug Somerville's doing a great job trialling the installation of sugar glider apartments to try and reduce the damage being done to new trees. He's an agronomist and also a farmer, and he's rehabilitating parts of his property in Bega. But he found the areas where he planted the young trees, there was all this juicy young vegetation, and it was attracting Christmas beetles. Now, I don't know how many Christmas beetles you get up in Brisbane, but Christmas beetles, their larvae grow in paddocks, and they will tend to chew the roots out of pasture. But then when they hatch, they will fly out and eat vast amounts of young vegetation, and they can kill trees sometimes. So he was having real trouble getting trees re-established on the property because of the numbers of Christmas beetles, and he thought, I wonder what eats Christmas beetles. I reckon sugar gliders do. So he built them little houses. He didn't actively relocate the sugar gliders, but there were patches of forest adjacent to his property. And what he's found is over the years, sugar gliders have been moving into those boxes and they've been eating the beetles.
Good stuff.
Yeah, so he's basically just, there's the lack of hollows, which is a big problem all over Australia, where we've cleared trees that are mature. And for a lot of trees, they don't form hollows till they're 100 years old. And those hollows can be really important habitat, not only for sugar gliders, but also for a whole range of birds, parrots, owls. So what he's doing is reintroducing an element in the landscape that's missing and trying to help the landscape rebalance itself in that regard.
It's brilliant. And look, the book is great reading as well. It's sort of written for kids, but adults will get a lot out of it. I know that we had a wonderful time going through it this morning. Thank you, Nick Gill.
Oh, so glad. Hey, pleasure, Kelly. It was lovely talking to you.
Nick Gill, and the book is Animal Eco-Warriors, Humans and Animals Working Together to Protect Our Planet, published by the CSIRO.
Streaming now at abc.net.au/Brisbane.
This is ABC Radio Brisbane and Queensland.